This episode is presented by Artifact Coffee and by the Indigo Road Restaurant and Consulting Group.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to Meant to Be Eaten. I'm Coral, the show's producer, in for Andrea this week. And joining me today is JT, head chef at Okonomi in East Williamsburg. Okonomi delicately toes the line between convention and craze, serving traditional Japanese breakfast, ichiju sansai by day, and not-so-traditional ramens by night. The methods of handling and treating ingredients are from Japan, while the ingredients themselves are local, the very same carrots you may have picked up last Wednesday in Union Square. Okonomi redefines and revisions what tradition and authenticity truly represent, and I'm pleased it's brought JT here on the show.
Hello, and thank you.
So what does a traditional Japanese breakfast consist of?
So ichiju sansai itself is basically one soup. Rice always comes with everything, pickles, and then three sides. So that's the sansai part, or ichiju is one soup, three sides. The sides could vary all the time. For instance, we do a baked tamagoyaki, so kind of like an egg omelet. We do a few tweaks because we don't have gas, so we cook it differently. Roasted fish, as well as, the third part kind of changes the most. The most common one is like a blanched vegetable with like a tofu dressing.
And is there a specific philosophy behind its creation and conception?
So, without getting too crazy and deep into it, it comes from a bunch of, or historically I would say it comes from history. Soup is always good to have, nutritious, easy to make, and a lot of your waste or byproducts can make a really delicious soup. So that is called motanai. It's a Buddhist philosophy about like minimizing your waste or not wasting anything, as well as appreciating the product indirectly. Not indirectly, but that also sounds really bad. But basically, you butcher your fish and you still have all these bones left. And for depending on the fish, let's say bluefish, since we serve that a lot, there's probably a good 30% of the fish by weight you could throw out, like the head, all the organs, bones. But in reality, the head and bones, you could just roast and make a nice stock out of it. If it's really, really awesome for like miso soup, for instance. And then different fish will provide different flavors. Pickles are almost always in... Pickles are pretty much in every single meal, some way. Throughout the world, it's, what is it, like 50% of food is easily fermented, if not more than probably 70% in reality. But pickling is a good way to preserve things and also kind of boosts the flavor of all the food in general. And then the blanched veg is more kind of more like a balanced, nutritious meal. You could do... doesn't necessarily have to be like a blanched green veg. It could be, you know, green beans. It could be a root veg. It could literally be anything. It just, you want to have, let's say, so my mom has this thing where she likes to have multiple colored vegetables because she feels like it's more nutritious that way. I don't know how true that is or not. It provides like different vitamins, different nutrients, which I guess, and looks prettier.
Yeah, and so at nighttime, the shop actually turns into a ramen shop as well. And what kinds of ramen do you serve?
So part of the whole motanai thing is we take the fish bones, blend it with chicken, make the broth for the nighttime. And a lot of the stuff, not a lot, but some of the stuff gets repurposed. We serve it mazumin style. So it's basically a thicker noodle, still has a nice chew thanks to like the kansui, which is the alkalinity. More pasta-ish. So one of our most popular ones is a bacon egg mazumin. It's kind of like a spin on a carbonara. And then we do the more ramen style, which is with broth. We specialize in the seafood, so everything has some kind of seafood component to it. And at this, in the same vein of the motanai, a lot of like tuna, like the belly fins and the bones are just straight up thrown out. We actually take that, roast it, and cook it at a boil so all the flavors and fat emulsifies in.
So can you talk a little bit more about the philosophy and how do you choose the ingredients you cook with and where do you source them from?
So for me, the basis of... the Japanese cooking philosophy is seasonal and regional, as well as not necessarily simple. Saying simple flavors sounds bad also, but more cleanliness and what the ingredient has to offer naturally. This is going to be a different tangent really quick. But if you look at a lot of traditional kaiseki cuisines, they actually don't add much salt or sugar or any at all, actually. If you add salt, well, in Western cuisine, it brings out like a certain flavor. It brings out more of like, oh, if you add salt to asparagus will taste more like asparagus to a certain point. But then all the more subtle flavors will be muted because that stronger flavor covers everything else up. And they want you to be able to taste pretty much everything.
Where are you sourcing ingredients?
So the other part is that the whole cuisine is based on seasonality and locality. It's throughout all. Oh, shit, how do I go about this now? Am I allowed to say that? Okay, I say shit. So we get all our stuff, all the seafoods from the Atlantic Ocean. Once in a while, we do get stuff from the Pacific Northwest, mainly salmon, just super abundant, and we don't feel as guilty about it. But we go as far south as maybe the Carolinas and then into Canada, but I'm not really sure the geography of Canada, so I can't really tell you how far it goes. But we try to stick to that. And then land-wise, it's maybe we go up as far as Maine, Pennsylvania as well. But we get as much of our stuff as possible closer to here. So we spend a lot of time at the market, and then just a lot of farmers and companies that help smaller farms ship together.
So wouldn't using locally sourced ingredients kind of limit your ability to be wholly Japanese or authentic? Because what if in, you know, some hypothetical situation or world, you could get all your ingredients from Japan and have radish from Japan and fish from Japan, and then would that experience prove to be more authentic than the other?
So I could see both sides to this argument. For me personally, I feel that that's kind of not cheating necessarily, but I'd rather follow the overall guideline versus then, oh, I need to, for this dish, I need this specifically and this other, you know, vegetables specifically. It kind of is like the ship of Theseus. It's like, is it going to be the same if I use different ingredients? I can make a braised dish instead of using, you know, let's say buri or hamachi, for instance. I use bluefish, which is only local to here, or not local, but in Atlantic. It's a little bit more oily. It's the same size about, fattiness as well. But is it, if I follow the same, you know, steps, if I take the same procedures, is it actually any less of a meal also? And that's like it's more of a philosophical question.
So you're able to remain true to the philosophy and not necessarily the flavor. I mean, it wouldn't taste the same exactly, but it still follows the same guidelines or philosophy?
Yeah, I think so. And now that, I guess, everything is literally flown, for instance, uni is flown from Maine to Japan, and then if nobody buys it, they'll fly back, and it'll be still pristine quality, probably better than a lot of like the middle tier sushi restaurants would get anyway. So that kind of muddles the whole situation, thanks to globalization.
Okay, so actually, an interesting note about the Okonomi team is that most of it, if not all of the team, is not Japanese. And how do you, is it possible to learn the subtle nuances of another's culture or tradition, do you think?
I'm going to have to say yes to save my own skin. But like I said, it's understanding or trying to figure out, and you want to kind of understand the philosophy behind, let's say, the cooking methods and how that came about and why that came about. And it's, for me, it's like, you have to learn. Basically, you have to learn, you have to appreciate it. Like, if you can't just pick up a recipe like, oh, I have sake, mirin, and soy sauce, it's going to be a Japanese dish. That's kind of bogus.
So, do you feel like you get kind of a unique point of view as someone who's not Japanese making Japanese food, or do you feel like that hinders you?
So, not... Actually, it's a funny thing. I thought about this... sometimes I lay in bed at night. I'm like, shit, dude, I'm running a Japanese restaurant, and I'm not a Japanese dude. I'm Taiwanese, so there's actually a ton of Japanese influence in Taiwan. They're colonized back in the day. My grandparents both speak Japanese pretty well. I can't say fluently because I don't know how well I speak because I can't speak Tamil myself. But I feel like not being Japanese, I have a certain amount of liberty. I could break out of the mold without being chastised for it. Because nobody's like, oh, he's a Japanese dude and he's doing something else. And it's like, that's not how it is. Whereas for me, I could change a dish and be like, oh, he's not Japanese, so it doesn't matter as much. And at the same time, it's kind of a... What kind of bites at me sometimes, or nips at me, is people like, oh man, this food's super good and all that, but then I'm curious, from Japanese people like, oh man, this is crazy good and all this, but I'm curious if it's because they're like, oh man, somebody else is not Japanese is making food to a certain quality and it's impressive, and it's kind of like a kind of hard to sleep sometimes. No, I'm kidding.
You sleep okay. So do you think there runs the risk of ethnic tourism in food? I mean, a lot of food now kind of depends on globalization or the cross-cultural blends of techniques or ingredients. And so you were saying that being as an outsider looking in, you're kind of given this unique freedom. But I mean, is it just because of the lower standard?
I think let's say I look at a dish, for instance, ayamono is basically a dress dish. There's very specific patterns people will follow, and if they're raised a certain way, they'll use specific things. But for me, in my brain, I don't have to view it as a specific thing. I don't have a memory linked to it. So for instance, okara is the leftover making tofu, and they'll, you could do say green bean okara. So you take the leftover making soy milk, and then you'll toss the green beans in there and season everything. Almond milk wasn't a big thing in Japan, but for instance, we can make almond milk here, and then I'm like, oh, someone's like, oh wait, why don't you just use the, you could do the same exact thing, just a totally different ingredient, and then most people won't have that connection. Or I'll add in shredded bits of mushroom or something. I don't have that preconceived notion of how a dish should be, so there's more mobility in that area.
So you were saying that there's a lot of Japanese influence in Taiwan. Do you feel like there are certain dishes you grew up eating that, I don't know, may have given you a better lens into Japanese cuisine and flavors, or are you also coming into it kind of blind?
So there's actually a lot of similarities to begin with. I don't want to say Japanese food is under-seasoned. It's under-seasoned by Western standards, traditionally. But in Taiwan, too, it's things aren't salted very heavily. You don't use a ton of soy sauce in something. But I remember specifically I was raised basically eating Japanese curry. I never thought it as specifically, oh, this is Japanese curry. This is what my mom makes. And then one day, I think it was late high school, early college, and someone's like, oh, let's go get some curry. I'm like, oh, sweet, I love curry. And then we go to the Indian restaurant, and I'm like, wait, they have curry here. That's interesting. And then it comes out, it's more watery, soupy. It's not that really, cornstarch-thickened curry that I'd expect. And kind of was like, wait a second, I had to go home. I did some homework. I'm like, oh, shit, this is where curry comes from. And it kind of woke me up. I was like, oh shit, I'm kind of ignorant actually. But I mean, I feel that it's a good thing because then kind of more introspective, I realized, oh, I could learn about much more stuff. I don't have to just be stuck in my own shell.
Yeah, I experience something like that quite often is where a lot of friends will recommend, oh, let's go get Chinese food, right? There's a Chinese food restaurant that I really want to take you to. And then we go, and it kind of is a lose-lose situation because either it has, Chinese chicken salad on the menu or chicken feet, and one of us feels uncomfortable. And how do you kind of navigate those situations?
Well, first, what is Chinese chicken salad?
Exactly, right? But it's like, it's a thing. There's like a salad section on a lot of Chinese restaurants or Chinese American restaurants. It's like Napa cabbage.
Is it like shredded?
Shredded chicken.
Like poached or bland, or steamed chicken,
yep.
And shredded.
Mm-hmm. Some, the wonton strips.
Oh, yeah, those are super, super Western.
Yeah. And those dishes, they kind of have come to represent a third hybrid culture, right? Like Chinese American food, like chop suey or orange chicken or all those things, which people take as Chinese food. And, I mean, there's something to be said about that.
I think it's a blend of Chinese cuisines, because there's so many different... I don't want to say peoples, but I might get killed by the PRC. There's so many different people that have different cuisines, and once they come to the U.S., they kind of drift together because that's where they feel safest. But their cuisines could be completely different, and if they're working in the same restaurant, at some point it'll kind of merge together or come closer together, and then whoever's buying it will have kind of, like you said, like a third hybrid, essentially. It's not like, oh, this is all from, you know, Sichuan, this is all Yunnan. It's just whatever people want it to be these days.
And
or their idea what it is.
Right, and it almost feels like a lot of those dishes are kind of dumbed down or adapted to Western tastes. And do you think that's a valid criticism, or...?
I wouldn't say dumbed down, but it's definitely adapted. It's a smart move. Like, why would you... You can't survive if you sell food that nobody wants to buy. Like, I wish there was, like, a really good stinky tofu restaurant or something, or, like, even, like, a stand. But you probably won't make a ton of money, and you probably get a shitload of complaints from people.
This is rotten. This is bad. So I'm actually talking to JT, who's the head chef at Okonomi here in East Williamsburg, and we are going to keep talking about cross-culturalism and Chinese chicken salad after the break.
Is that where we are?
This episode is presented by Artifact Coffee, serving food and drink to fuel body and soul. Brought to you by the team behind Woodbury Kitchen, Artifact Coffee is located in the restored Union Mills complex. They source their beans from Counterculture in Raleigh, and with help from partners like Great Kids Farm, Black Rock Orchard, and Oasis Creamery, they serve food that is fresh, local, and handcrafted, all day, every day. This episode is also presented by the Indigo Road Restaurant and Consulting Group. The Indigo Road was founded in Charleston, South Carolina in 2009 by managing partner Steve Palmer. It has since grown to include 16 restaurants in the Carolinas, Georgia, and Tennessee, and it's still growing. Several projects are currently in the works, including Donetto in Atlanta. But the Indigo Road is more than its restaurants. Steve Palmer maintains the philosophy that great service starts with well-cared-for employees. He believes in promoting from within, creating new opportunities for his staff, and developing a strong company culture. As culinary and industry leaders, the Indigo Road also specializes in restaurant and hotel consulting services, providing customized solutions to each. Learn more at indigoroad.com.
And we're back. I'm here with JT, head chef at Okonomi in East Williamsburg, and we were just talking about this kind of third hybrid cuisine that happens with Chinese-American takeout, like General Tso's chicken and chop suey. And at night, so Okonomi actually turns into a ramen shop, and they have, you know, a lot more, I'd say maybe Western ingredients or Western styles of ramen. One of them is the bacon and egg ramen, which made famous by Master of None. And do you think there's a kind of adaptation or avoidance that happens with the bacon and egg ramen as well?
It's definitely an adaptation. Like I said, you want to... A lot of people are proud of their heritage and want to bring out a dish. Or, I mean, they want to, you know, bring out the entire restaurant, basically. Like, oh, this is where I'm from, this is where we serve. But people are kind of afraid of change, or a lot of people are afraid of new taste, for instance. And these adaptations kind of essentially help people get into something else. It's like people are more willing to take the baby steps. And then once they kind of take that, they're like, oh, this is actually pretty good. They go a few times, they talk a little bit more. Once the education then picks up as well, and then before you know it, they're like, oh, doing homework, like, oh, this is, you know, this dish comes from here. They use this traditionally in this way. And then let's say they'll look online, like, oh, there's a class on how to, you know, cut sashimi, for instance. And then it just escalates in a positive way. And a lot of people like to, you know, kind of like stomp down, like, oh, this is a crappy takeout spot where they serve general sales or something, but it's everybody kind of has their own safe spot. You want them to, you know, get more into the authenticity of something, which I also hate as a word. Well, I don't hate it. It's kind of annoying. I feel like people should let, you know, other people enjoy what they like. It's not harming anybody that much. And it'll kind of help push them towards what certain people consider as, you know, the real, you know, Chinese cuisine, for instance. And it's how it should be, dude. It's nobody picks up an entire cuisine in one day.
In one bite.
Yeah.
There's a similar criticism, or I guess the reason that there's this huge mysticism surrounding Japanese cuisine is that there's really no definitive guide to Japanese cooking since that one book we were talking about, like The Art of Simple Cooking, right? And so do you think Japanese chefs are hesitant to provide a new guide, or is it just kind of the way the tradition is, where it's about perfecting a certain method or perfecting a certain recipe, and it's less about innovation, it's more just, I don't know.
So I'm going to say this as someone that's completely outside of circles. Oh man, I'm gonna get like killed today.
Once you step outside the studio.
Yeah. Is window bulletproof? But so the chef from Narasawa, there's some article that came out maybe a few months ago. He's talking about how Japanese cuisine hasn't really progressed. I mean, it's progressed in like the details. Like everything's gotten better, but there has been no real revolution or improvement. If you go pretty much anywhere in Europe, for instance, you go in the kitchen, there's always at least one or two Japanese people working there. And usually what happens is they learn from that person, whoever the chef is there, and they go back to Japan, then they open their own spot. But they almost essentially follow the direction to a T. This person I know, I'm not going to rat her out, but we were joking one day. Kind of serious, half joking. But she said basically, Japanese and Taiwanese people also really good at taking something and developing it and making it better and better, but we're not necessarily the best at, you know, brand new inventions or creativity, which I also kind of disagree on sometimes, but it's a super valid point.
And so in addition to the breakfast and ramen services, there are also those weekly tasting events that you host, and what do you think those tasting events convey that breakfast and ramen can't? You're talking about innovation and maybe breaking outside the mold for a little bit. And yeah, what do those events do for you?
So the breakfast basically is bringing Japanese philosophy into New York. The ramen is kind of a mixed spin. It's kind of showcase more local seafood more than actual ramen itself. And then the tasting menu is more of a conglomerate of all that, plus being in New York, which is already home to so many different cultures. So it's not just, it's based of, you know, Japanese cooking philosophy, but also what we pick up from being in New York, like all the restaurants you visit, all the food trends, all the ingredients. It's much more freedom. It kind of toes the line between, is this Japanese, is this not Japanese? But at the same time, like kaiseki itself, the sake style, the hot cuisine, kind of influenced so many tasting menus to begin with in the world. And that's one of the current trends. So it's not, kind of lost myself. Start ranting too much. But it's not not as hard and fast about, oh, this is a kaiseki meal. And plus also there's something else called a cha kaiseki, which is a tea style kaiseki meal. It's rooted more in like a Buddhist and humble and tea origins. It's not about, what can I import that's the most expensive and crazy flavorful thing? it's more about presenting a certain level of hospitality, learning what the guest wants, and then you present that food. Like, oh, you like eating this thing, so I'm going to serve this. And it's just being like a good host, basically.
I feel like a lot of Okonomi's press or popularity stems from, you know, its Instagrammability or how pretty it looks on the plate. And what, how do you think that affects the experience?
It definitely draws in a crowd, which is good. But a lot of people, I feel like, are just in it, not necessarily just for Instagram, which kind of some people are. But the whole instant gratification thing, people go there or they go out, they just want to eat. They want to get the food right away and eat, or they want to take a nice picture, but they kind of miss out on the entire experience. It's like we go traveling to a different country and you spend your entire time taking, you know, photos. You're going to miss that feeling of being there because you're already stuck in, oh, how do I fit this lovely picture in the fucking rectangle? Mm-hmm. Sorry, I got to stop doing that. But so we try to provide a remotely healthy meal, and by remotely it's actually probably really, really healthy. We don't use much oil. A lot of it's just natural fish oil, no butter. But they miss out on the hospitality side. It's not very tangible. It's a bit harder from due to language barriers. But regardless, we're playing music at a certain BPM, so it's not crazy. It's not too slow. You're not gonna fall asleep. You're not going to have a heart attack. And we just treat everybody with straight up, you know, respect. And then we kind of hope most of the time they always send it back as well. So it provides like a super nice, serene environment. During the weekdays, a lot of people come by themselves, just like have a nice meal, hang out. They're not getting crushed by, you know, they just drop all that external work pressure they have or whatever else is going on in their life. That's kind of, you know, dragging them down, and it's just sitting there enjoying the meal, enjoying the environment. And I feel like a lot of people don't understand the experience aspect of just eating in general. Like, people can see that, oh, they go to a super high-end restaurant, they're going to get good service, even though they don't understand what that means. And then they understand also they'll go to McDonald's, for instance, and they'll get, you know, they'll get whatever food, and then a certain type of experience. But in the middle ground, people can't really comprehend. Like, oh, this kind of seems expensive. And I feel like they just can't grasp. Like, if a server makes an error, it's something that, oh shit, we had a bad service today. It's super noticeable. But if someone does something perfectly fine, like let's say your server's 100%, most people don't really notice that because it's not breaking the system. I don't know how to explain that.
It's kind of like a dehumanized service almost.
Yeah, it's kind of like they feel like they treat me like that, but it's also, they're just not aware, they're not appreciating and aware of the current experience, I guess. Which is also super, super Buddhist.
Right, I mean, with something like the Japanese breakfast where they've seen these photos on Instagram and pretty much all photos look pretty identical, they kind of come expecting the same experience every time. And is that not the desired experience you want them to have?
I mostly just want people to come in and have a good time. Not, or at least be content. I feel like being content is kind of spun a different way these days versus being happy. Like, being happy is like, you know, super positive. But being content is, I feel, is more as like being happy about how everything is, or appreciating that you're alive and your life is going this way. Bad things happen, but you just learn from that.
I just think there's this kind of misconception with Japanese food or sushi or something that it's all about perfection, like almost inhuman perfection and consistency every single time. And is that something you strive for as well?
I feel like that's why a lot of, aside from having labor force issue, I don't mean us, I mean in Japan, sorry, but us also. Like, if you look at a lot of shops, they'll have like a ramen shop, they'll have like, you know, a vending machine booth where you pick it out, you get a ticket, you hand a ticket in, and that's it. But then if you look at all the higher end places, like, you know, any places, omakase, even though it's not, a ton of people working, there's a lot more of that hospitality aspect. I remember doing like kaiseki meals, for instance, and then we finish eating, we're leaving, but then the staff would kind of like follow us out, and like we walked pretty much like 40, 50 feet, and they're still following us and waving goodbye, and I'm like, oh man, it's like, I can't tell if it's awkward or nice, but I felt it was like a really nice gesture, basically.
We'll have to start doing that at the restaurant. Follow people home. And actually, speaking of, so Okonomi is situated in Williamsburg, which is a neighborhood that's long been pretty settled or comfortable with its gentrified status. And have you noticed any difference in the customers it attracts, or the type of cultures that the community it fosters?
We get a pretty diverse crowd. Our original goal is kind of just to be a neighborhood restaurant, provide for a neighborhood, but we kind of got too popular, I guess. And then, so we become more of a destination. People, take Ubers all the time. They're visiting from wherever. We also get a lot of people that kind of fly straight in from Japan and just like, oh, we just came from Japan. And I'm like, in my head, I'm kind of like, what are you guys? You guys came all the way from Japan. You're going to eat a similar meal. But it's very, very heartwarming, though, at the same time. And it's, I'm actually, no matter how much sometimes, like, man, you guys should eat somewhere else, but it feels good, basically. Like, people want to show us their love, basically, or appreciation, and then so we want to show our love back to them. The neighborhood itself has changed quite a bit, at least in the past 10 years. Like, 10 years is significant change. But a lot of the, it hasn't changed that much in our side of the BQE. Whereas on Bedford, there's maybe three bars that are the same, that have been there forever. Every other bar like has just basically shut down, replaced by, let's say, was that Dunkin' Donuts. So replaced Spike Hill, I think. Or there's like a Uniqlo pop-up or something, but Whole Foods, Duane Reade.
Apple Store.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that. I don't walk by there.
Apple
yeah.
Store, yeah. So in addition to the ramen and the breakfast and the tasting, there's also the new fish market. And so what can people get at the fish market, and who's your target customer?
So the fish, it kind of all stems from Yuji, who's the mastermind behind all these things. He used to be a seafood purveyor, and he wanted people to actually, he saw so much waste in the fishing industry here. He wanted to kind of cut down on waste, but also show people that seafood is actually still amazing. So eventually we opened the fish market, Osakana. It kind of follows in the same vein as the other spots. It's just about treating your product with care, like people always say, oh, this farm table, this is, sustainable. But it's more about how you handle how each person like working handles whatever the product is. And I feel like that's how, if you go to Tsukiji in Japan, all the fish there is not only pristine because people send the best stuff there, but everybody there takes the best care of what, they're not like carrying the fish in the center so the head and tail kind of flop down and make like a frowny face, I guess. Like that just tears up the meat. And just knowing, it's just caring about your product, and you have to understand that it's, sure, you could catch, 100 fish and sell it, and you could catch for whatever and do whatever to it, or you could catch one fish and it'll sell for way less. But it's more of like a pride thing. Like I want my own thing to be good. And I think the pride is a pretty huge factor. Sorry, that's kind of a weird rant.
So today I've been speaking with JT, who's the head chef at Okonomi in East Williamsburg, which serve traditional Japanese breakfast in the morning and ramen, or more hype ramen, at night. And remember, whether it's chicken feet or bacon and egg ramen, it's meant to be eaten.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.